Folks, if we'll have a seat, we can get started with the meeting. Good morning, everyone. This is the opportunity that we take from time to time to get a report from the North Carolina Advanced Energy Corporation. We're glad to have Advanced Energy here to make a report for us, and we're glad people to have people in the audience to hear what the report is. We look forward to having you every time you come, and we're glad to get caught up on what the Advanced Energy Board is doing. And so we will turn the program over to Fred Alphen, who's the chair of the corporation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Commission, we appreciate the opportunity to share this information with you. It's very exciting to us. But just before we get started, I'd like to introduce our board members. If you just stand, please, just briefly so we can see you. Tony Almeida, who's former assistant to the governor. Kendall Vogelman, the Duke Energy. Alan Butler with Weaver Cook Construction. Henry Campin, Poe Adams and Bernstein. Bill Colby, North Carolina State Board of Education. Dr. Bob Coger here, as we all know. Mr. Bob Powell with NCANT. And that is our present board. I'll turn it over to Dr. Coger.
Thank you, Fred. We're happy to be here. We learned a long time ago that we can't cover everything we do in one of these presentations. So we select a couple of topics every year to let you know what we're doing and how we think we're making progress in these areas. Today we're going to be talking about quality. Installers are having trouble, or they're struggling with code issues, and we're trying to help them in those areas. We're going to talk about the residential area and in the PV area. Christy Matthews will lead off in the residential area, then Sean Fitzpatrick will follow up in the PV. Christy?
Okay. Good morning. I just want to thank everyone for having me here to speak. This is an interesting topic to me, and I've been involved in it for a couple years now. So I'm glad that it's actually getting to the point where we're working with utilities with energy codes. And today I'm going to talk to you about how it's become a hot topic for a couple of different reasons. Basically, number one, we're looking at energy codes passing across the country. And we know that if an energy code passes on a residential home January, in February, that does not mean that the home is actually, new homes are meeting the energy code. So that's one thing that we have determined. We don't know what the actual calculation is as far as how long it does take for homes to start meeting a new residential energy code, but we know that it's not instantaneous. So we also know that utilities are starting to look for additional savings. We understand that a lot of the above code programs are out there and have been running for a while, but these energy codes are kind of catching up to above code programs, so they're looking for additional savings. And we know that states and local jurisdictions have a limited amount of resources and people to help energy codes get implemented and to sustain compliance over a number of years. We also know that the energy codes around the nation are moving quick. And so at the end of this presentation, I'm going to show you three different examples on three different states and how the utilities within the states are applying some support to, like, official filed support for energy code programs. So just to start off, I needed to give you a little bit of background about what we've been doing at Advanced Energy for energy codes. In the past couple years, we started down the road of building resource and reference manuals along with web resources for around 22 different states. We're on the path to get the entire nation, but we've hit 22 different states. We've provided training, development, and delivery within North Carolina, Texas, Georgia, and Arizona. And we are a part of the DOE compliance study through a partnership with SEEA, the Southeast Energy Efficiency Alliance, where we are studying the what is the compliance rate of residential homes in Arkansas and Georgia. And then in Arkansas, we'll be doing a number of trainings and other circuit rider programs in order to help push that implementation and compliance forward. Here's just to show you kind of what states we've hit so far with providing resources. We have a website called successwithenergycode.com where anyone can go on and they can download free of charge checklists and tech tips for all the different details needed to complete an energy code in that specific state. So all of these different states, they have very customized resources for those. So I thought it might be important to talk about the codes process. We all had to learn this in order to figure out how to fit advanced energy in there and help as much as we could. So basically with energy codes, you have the energy code development activity, you have adoption, and then you have implementation and enforcement. With development, typically all states are going to use a national model energy code. For the residential side, which is what I deal with mostly, it's the International Energy Conservation Code, the IECC. In North Carolina, we've adopted the 2009 IECC with amendments. And so when you move towards adoption, that can either happen at the state level, like we do here in North Carolina, or it could happen at a local or jurisdictional level, or a city level. I know in Texas, they have over 30 to 40 different types of energy code that they have to keep up with across the state. And often when a code is adopted, it is amended to some sort of extent. So in Georgia, I know they've made a lot of amendments to their code. Here in North Carolina, the same deal. And sometimes they have a stretch code to kind of encourage builders to go the extra mile. And then when you come to code implementation, that is where things get a little tricky. We're looking at how codes are enforced in different ways across different jurisdictions. That always happens at a local level. So there really isn't a lot of similarity in how compliance is being reached. And that's where we come in to try and help builders, trades, and code officials understand sort of a compliance or a way to meet compliance in the same way. So why all this interest in energy, in supporting codes and standards? Well, like I said before, utilities are looking for that savings because their above code programs are getting so close to the energy code. They know that supporting an energy code program could offer very high, highly cost-effective savings. There's a lot of other incentives that are out there pushing builders and trades to meet this standard, not just a utility program with financial incentives. And the code is moving at a rapid pace, and then we can't forget about the ARRA requirements. So every state, of course, that accepted ARRA funds or has committed to adopt national model codes and implement a plan to reach 90% compliance by 2017. So, and in addition, create a plan to measure that compliance within 8 years. As you can imagine, a lot of the states are going, okay, how are we going to do this? What's the methodology? And so that is why there's been this has been a hot topic across the country. With that significant cost-effective savings, we're seeing some big jumps. When the 2010 IECC is 30% more efficient than 2004, and that's in commercial codes with ASHRAE 90.1. But in the residential area, we're also seeing big jumps. 2006 IECC to 2012 IECC, there's a 30% jump. So that's a significant amount of savings where the utilities are trying to catch up. And not only utilities, but also national programs such as Energy Star is trying to catch up and figure out what to do to get higher than Energy Code. I grabbed this graphic from ACEEE. It's something to kind of let you see how rapid things have changed since around 2008 till now, where we've dropped in the energy use index considerably. And then the only thing that's missing there is the 2015 IECC, which is another jump in code. And I think it's important to realize that even with all of this jump in new code, it's significant energy savings or energy efficiency increases. So we've been working with this issue and talking to many different utilities about, you know, how they feel about energy codes and supporting energy codes. So here are some of the concerns and some of the questions that we've heard from them. Number one, utilities, and this is no surprise, utilities don't want to be the enforcer of something that's supposed to already be mandated by the state. They also don't want to be perceived as a group that is standing behind new code adoption. They don't want to be in that position, and totally understandable. They ask the question, you know, we have this above code program, how are energy codes going to affect, if we start supporting energy codes, how is that going to affect our above code program? How do you prove the savings? And then how do you prove that you're not double counting? Because there's a lot of different entities out there that are helping energy codes, energy code compliance. So I thought I would just start out by talking about a little bit about attribution. And I know that in the state of Arizona, we've worked with a number of different utilities that are doing this now, but in the state of Arizona, this is kind of how they started out their attribution, looking at how we separate savings. Number one, they created a group, of course, that these are homes out there that have, they have to meet the energy code, but they have no utility training, they have no code support program, and so that is a percentage of the energy savings there. The other groups are the homes with energy code and with a utility training code support program, and that has a percentage of energy savings. And then lastly, there's the group of homes that are in the above code programs. So that has its own group of savings. And so these are ways that they've separated this out in Arizona to look at how things can be attributed. So instead of the utility being the enforcer, which we all know they don't want to be, you know, it's important to point out that utilities that are running residential new construction programs have tried for years to become that trusted advisor to the builders and to trades. They want to be the energy expert. So they put themselves in that position of helping builders achieve a higher standard. And I don't think there's any difference between what they're doing with above code programs and what they would do to support an energy code program. So they can be positioned as the facilitator to help translate that code, because it is sometimes a very overwhelming task to understand all the different details within an energy code. But they can help to translate that into different details and processes for the builders and the subs, and get that message out to the builders that, hey, if you guys can do this and do it right the first time, you can get better work from your subcontractors, you can reduce your callbacks, you can meet the code more efficiently so that you're saving money ultimately, which is what they're wanting to do. They can also work with the code officials. I think sometimes we just think about the code officials and not the builders when it comes to code, but they can work with the code officials so they can understand the background of energy code. Code officials have a big job. They're not just dealing with energy code. We all know that. Their main concern is safety, and they spend a lot of their time focusing on those details. So it would be helpful to help code officials understand building science and the relationship to the new energy code. This in turn will help significantly have more consistency and enforcement across the state and reduce a lot of conflicting guidance. We found that in North Carolina, there are some code officials who go to the state level to get a code interpreted for them. Some go to their local jurisdiction. So but they all kind of do a different thing. So there's not a lot of consistency there. And so the utilities can also work within their communities on technical support and pull in the third party energy advisors, such as the home energy raters, so that everything can be a consistent message across the market. So I wanted to kind of go through some of the benefits of an official code support program. I think utilities that have started running these types of programs have found that this is driving very low cost energy savings. You know, as I said before, there's a lot of other things going on. It's a, number one, it's a mandatory set of standards. And so to provide some training support, circuit riders, maybe some collaborative events, as very low cost to get some savings out into the market. It also captures a broader share of the market, so you reach a larger percent of customer sites, and you reduce that lost opportunity from non-participants. So a lot of times when they're looking at, oh, well, in a new above code program, there are gonna be a lot of non-participants. In this type of program, you're really reaching everyone, all builders, because they are all under the mandate to meet the energy code. You can coordinate with your above code program. You know, the building science that you teach for Energy Star or a residential program is the same building science that you teach for meeting an energy code. So it's very easy to kind of coordinate efforts on those two things. And you can better understand, if a utility starts running this sort of program, they can better understand compliance rates as they are. We're involved in the DOE compliance study, and we're looking at compliance rates in Arkansas and Georgia right now. There has never been a compliance study done in those states to understand, are they really meeting energy code? What level? And so we're going in looking at 8 different aspects of the code in 53 different homes, or 53 times, I should say. So we're reaching about over 200 homes in those states to see what kind of percentage we're looking at. And I believe that resource planning decisions could be better informed if the utilities did that. A lot of times in states, we're finding that utilities are opposing energy codes because of the way that it affects the savings on their above code programs. So there's typically an adversarial relationship between utilities and energy codes. We have also found in the states where utilities are starting to support energy codes, this is kind of switching. They're actually becoming more supportive of the activity, not adoption or enforcement, but of compliance and just help in the compliance area. And this is a greater equity basically for all ratepayers because you're reaching a broader audience of participants. So if a utility was going about, wanted to go and run an official code support program, here are the steps that they would take. Number one, they would try to figure out what their potential energy savings is in that state or in their territory. And that would include doing a compliance study of some sort, some kind of baseline to figure that out. You can do that with computer modeling. You can do some infield checks. But that is going on in 7 different states right now. And we are using a methodology that PNNL created that DOE is promoting. You need to select your program elements. What are you gonna do? What does this mean? We're gonna do training. You're gonna do third-party inspections, maybe. You're gonna do some code collaboratives, perhaps a circuit rider program. A lot of states we're seeing are doing circuit riders where someone is going around to the different jurisdictions to help them understand the code a little bit better. Number 3, you're gonna determine what your attribution rate is. So we know not all energy savings due to the increased compliance is from the utility's action. So where is that all attributed? And how can we all agree upon that? Number 4 is allocation among the utilities. And in this case, I pulled this from Illinois. This is where they were doing a statewide effort. If there are multiple utilities involved, how is that allocated? And if there's different fuels involved, how is that allocated? And then you need to run your cost effectiveness test to see, you know, how is this, what does this look like on TRC and the other tests? And then, of course, prepare and file the program. So I wanted to go over three different states. They're all in different levels of involvement with energy codes, and so it kind of shows you, you know, how states can move from getting involved to maybe a statewide effort. I want to start with North Carolina. North Carolina is a recipient of the Energy Code Compliance Study from DOE. Within Duke Energy Progress, I want to highlight some of the activity that they've been doing that is, that they don't have a formal energy code program, but they are supporting the stretch code through their above code program. They have a residential new construction program where they're using the stretch code, and they guarantee the results. They guarantee the heating and cooling usage on those homes. They provide energy code technical training, both on the basic code and stretch code. And I think that it's important to point out that they also provide market transformation efforts around teaching realtors and appraisers what this means. This is a huge effort that's going around the country where utilities are teaching realtors how to sell the value of energy efficient homes, how to put this stuff in MLS, and then all the way to the point where they're teaching the appraisers how to value this these additional aspects of the home. Duke Energy Progress is also participating in a Delphi panel, I know with Navigant, to get closer to a real baseline. What kind of market transformation efforts have worked within their territory, and what does that look like? Move along to Georgia. We do a number of trainings in Georgia. We work with Georgia Power a lot. They are also a recipient of the Energy Code Compliance Study. We're going to be doing the compliance study in year three of this for them. In 2013, they paid around $100,000 to do 10 different trainings around the state. They also purchased all the printed material to distribute to the different jurisdictions. They do realtor and appraiser training as well. And some of the recent activity, they've met with their Public Service Commission, with SIA, and with us to kind of talk about what this official energy code support program would look like. They've gone to all the stakeholder meetings, and right now they've made the decision to move forward with oversampling. The code compliance study is providing measurement, but it's not providing measurement specifically for Georgia Power territory. So they wanted a more dense sample to satisfy the needs of their EMMB contractor. So that's kind of an example of dipping their toe in the water and they're moving forward. Now, I want to give an example of what Illinois is doing. Illinois is a different can of worms. They have decided to do something on a statewide level, and this is not just for one utility. This is involving, as you can see here, Ameren, Illinois, ComEd, Peoples Gas, Nicor, and the Department of Commerce and Economic Activity, which is basically their state energy office, and they have all come together to decide on all aspects of those steps that I showed a while ago. They went through every one of those steps together in a collaborative process. The parts of their program include collaboratives, trainings and resources, circuit riders, third-party inspectors, and plan reviews for different jurisdictions. And after they completed their cost-effectiveness screening, they figured out they have a 5.85 on their TRC for this program, and of course this is including gas and electric. I think it's interesting to point out the great thing about the statewide effort is they all shared the concern over low compliance. They had like a 50% compliance, and they're reaching in the 70s now. And so they all played on their different strengths. The State Energy Office had great training, so they just increased the training that the State Energy Office is doing, and the utility took on other aspects of the program, and they all decided to work together. So that gives you three different examples of how states are approaching this issue, and we think this is important to kind of understand moving forward in North Carolina and in the Southeast in general. So that's all of my presentation today. Thank you for your time.
There might be questions.
Oh, okay. I thought.
Are you on it?
Yeah. If there's questions, I looked on the agenda. I knew there were time for questions at the end.
Well, that might be better. Whatever Chairman says.
Let's wait till the end.
Okay.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Sean Fitzpatrick with Advanced Energy here in Raleigh. Today I wanted to talk to you about some inspections we did in late 2014 for Duke Energy, interconnection inspections of utility scale PV plants. And these are customer owned PV plants. We conducted these inspections as part of our 2014 service account work, and we inspected 15 sites, and those were identified by Duke Energy Progress for us, sites that they wanted to know a little bit more about what is actually out in the field. These were sites in the range of a half a megawatt up to 3.3 megawatts, and we did those inspections last winter, September through December. The scope of our inspection included five main areas. First area was related to transformer compliance with the inverter instructions. The second was the inverter and transformer compliance with what they told the utilities they would install. The third was interconnection protection settings. Fourth is something that we've been doing a lot of in the last few years is electrical code compliance, and so we decided to go ahead and include that in the inspection. However, that's normally the purview of the electrical inspection authority, not necessarily the utility, but the utility wants to know what is this equipment safe that's actually out there. And then finally, we did a high-level performance evaluation of the 15 sites just to get a handle on how well are these installations working compared to what everyone expects. So a little technical background before I dive in. Just wanted to clarify, you know, the difference between transformers and inverters. Sometimes they're used synonymously, but we're talking about two separate devices here. I'm speaking of customer-owned transformers. Usually, most buildings have a utility-owned transformer, but most of these solar farms have a customer-owned transformer. So that transformer is the piece of equipment that transfers the solar farm's low-voltage power up to utility distribution-level voltage. Secondly, the inverter that I'm speaking of here, the inverter converts the DC power produced by the solar photovoltaic array into utility-compatible AC electricity, and it also usually provides the interconnection protective features. So here in this photo, the two main components, the inverter and the transformer, showed. The white box on the left is the transformer, and the white box in the middle there is the inverter. These are both 0.5 megawatt inverters and transformers. This is a common size we've seen at all the 15 sites we inspected. So once we did our inspections and summarized everything we learned a few things that we didn't even expect to learn, but we took those findings and put them into five key finding areas. We've got transformer requirements, we've got interconnection documentation versus actual installation, we've got interconnection settings, electrical code compliance, and performance evaluations. So I'll go through those one at a time now. So for transformer requirements, the inverter manufacturers specify the type of transformers that their inverters are listed to be operated with to ensure that the inverter has proper interconnection protection built in. Advanced Energy found that some transformer types that were being used created a situation where the inverter was not able to detect a power outage on a single phase of the utility three-phase distribution line. In fact, we found that 4 of the 15 sites we inspected, they had this problem. Now, this is a potential safety concern, a very, very significant safety concern that we found. Didn't expect to find this one as part of this study. So, as a result, Duke Energy has gone back to these site owners and has required additional safety measures, and Duke Energy themselves are taking additional safety measures for linemen working in the vicinity of these sites. Next, we're going to talk about interconnection documentation and what they said they were going to build compared to what was actually built. So for each site, Duke Energy has on file an interconnection request that the solar farm developer submitted, said this is what I will build. There's an interconnection agreement. The legal requirement says, okay, this is, we both agree to allow this plant to operate in a certain manner. We were provided with that documentation from Duke Energy and used that to compare with what we actually saw out in the field when we visited these 15 sites. And it turns out that at 9 of the 15 sites, there were significant deviations from what they said they were going to build compared to what they actually built. And this table here shows the different areas of the non-compliance. Sometimes the solar field was larger than what they said they were going to build, but, you know, on the order of maybe 10 or 20% larger. Sometimes the inverter, or frequently the inverter type was a different brand or model number. And of course the utilities, when they had the study, when they looked at the inverter to make sure it seemed like it was going to be okay, they assumed it was one inverter type. Now when the builder built the site and used a different inverter, this is all new. Really need to go back to the drawing board and look at that inverter and make sure it's safe. Also found that transformer sizes were significantly different. Might have said they were going to put in a megawatt transformer of one configuration, and they ended up putting a half a megawatt transformer of a different delta or Y configuration. I'll move on now to interconnection protection settings. First, I'll define what interconnection protection settings are. These are the settings that are built into the inverter or the protective relay equipment that keeps the solar PV plant from continuing to energize a utility line even during a utility power outage, whether it's an intentional outage or an outage due to a storm. This is one of the most important safety features of any solar plant, is to keep that solar plant from energizing a utility line when it's not supposed to. Duke Energy Progress requires site owners to adjust the interconnection protection settings to a different set of settings than the inverter came from the factory with. And these settings I'm speaking of are mainly voltage and frequency related, and this table here is the current set of settings that Duke Energy Progress is asking site builders to abide with. What we found is no sites actually complied with interconnection protection settings that they agreed to comply with. And in regard to that, we found that under frequency at all the sites was adjusted incorrectly, which led to the solar farms tripping offline before the utility would like them to trip offline. And we also found that due to voltage, the solar farms would take longer than the utility would desire to trip offline due to an abnormal voltage event. A real interesting finding here at one of the sites, they had an advanced energy inverter. Now this is advanced energy out of Colorado, not my advanced energy, but the advanced energy inverter manufacturer. They're one of the largest in the world. And we were at a site, we saw this label on the side of the inverter, said, oh great, they're complying with the requirements. It says right here on the label, these voltage and frequency set points are exactly what Duke Energy has asked them to do. Then we hooked up our laptop computer to the inverter and looked at the set points within the inverter and found out, nope, they're not, they don't. Just because there's labels on there, it doesn't mean the settings are actually right. And the settings did not comply with what the utility was asking for. So it was, at first, looked great. Upon further investigation, there was a problem. Okay, our next key finding area was related to electrical code compliance. We kept our electrical code compliance inspections to right there at that inverter equipment pad where the transformers and the inverter are. We were not going out into the solar field. That's kind of the customer's business, the site owner's business. But that interconnection equipment right there, the interface between the solar farm and the utility grid, that is the utility's business. So that's the site's, that was the area we focused on. We found that at two sites, they didn't have the customer-owned service disconnect that is required by code to allow the site to quickly be shut down in case of an emergency. At one of those sites, they actually did have a service disconnect, but it was located half a mile away from the solar farm at a poorly marked location, which no first responder would likely know where it was located. This photo here shows you that site. We've got the solar field in the upper left corner, and then half a mile away as crow flies is the pad mount service disconnect. Turns out that the winding road to get to that disconnect, you're really driving 3/4 to a full mile before you can get to that disconnect, even if you know where it's located. So this is an unsafe condition. Would be difficult for first responders to quickly shut down the solar farm in case of a fire. The other major electrical code violation we ran into at a lot of sites, 8 of 15 sites were missing the AC ground detectors that are required at that transformer between the transformer and the inverter. And again, this makes for an unsafe condition if a ground fault would occur on that AC conductor. Finally, I'll move on to the last key finding area related to performance evaluations. We visited the sites, as I said, in September through December. Not the most ideal conditions for evaluating solar performance, but we had to deal with what we were dealt. And we did have favorable enough weather conditions at 10 of the 15 sites that we could do our performance evaluation. And the way we evaluated performance is we looked at how much the solar farm was producing, divided that by what it should have been producing given the weather, solar, and temperature conditions. Our findings are summarized in this table here for the 10 sites. On average, all sites, the weighted average was an 88.6% performance factor. We had hoped or expected to see that all sites would be producing at least 90% or better of the expected power. But what we found was 88.6 was the average, but we had a lot of sites that were much lower than that. We had some sites coming in at 79%, 80%. And in this table, at three sites, it was pretty obvious to us what was causing this low performance. One, at the first site, 8% of the array was out of service. The the contractor told us when we got there, hey, we've got part of our site down because we have a ground fault in one of these underground feeders. We had to shut it off a couple weeks ago. At another site, it was obvious there was vegetation growing up through the solar array, and we knew there was significant shading. And then at the third site, turned out they had a bad combiner box that was covering about 4.5% of that site. So that part of the array was turned off, bringing its performance down to 86%. Again, we hoped to see more, 90% or better, but we didn't. So this is one of the sites where we saw vegetation growing up through the solar array. This amount of shading is just pretty detrimental to performance, and this was wintertime. Can you imagine what it would be in the summertime or in the spring once this growth, if this growth continued? We asked the site superintendent, how often do you mow? What's going on here? And they were a little perplexed and said, we thought we had someone under contract to mow the lawn here, but clearly we don't. It turned out this O&M service provider is based in Colorado. They don't get to the East Coast very often to actually check their sites. But yeah, this site was losing at least 14% of its power production when we were there on a winter day. In a summer day, it would probably have been higher. Okay, so I ran through our key findings, what we expected to find, but I want to share with you another interesting finding that we didn't initially expect, and that was at one site, we had told them we needed to look at the transformers, we need to look at this, that, and the other, but when we arrived, they were not aware that they owned the transformer. They thought the utility company owned the transformer. And so they didn't have the keys to get into the transformer. They looked in their truck, they didn't have the keys. Clearly they've never looked inside the transformer in the past 2 or 3 years. And once they went to the hardware store, took them 3 trips to the hardware store to buy a pair of bolt cutters, they broke the bolt cutters, they went and bought an angle grinder, got back, they didn't have a battery for the angle grinder. Went back a third time, got the battery, got the locks cut off 2 hours later. You held us up quite a bit. When they did get the transformer open, we found some problems that they did not know about. And we found that the conductor insulation was burned off the wires inside the transformer, which means that these wires have been overheating. You know, God knows why. We didn't delve into it. That's their job to figure out. But this is a very unsafe condition with the insulation burning off these wires. That could likely lead to a transformer fire, or at least lead to an inverter failing prematurely or a transformer failing prematurely. Also, in that same transformer, we found that on the medium voltage side, the over on the 23 kV side, one of the lightning surge arresters had blown out. I've got a white arrow there pointing to the cap. There were a lot of black residue that blown out of that elbow arrester when the event occurred, whether it was a lightning strike or a line contact somewhere else. But what that means is something bad happened and they didn't know about it. It also means that they no longer have surge protection on this transformer like they expect. So now that transformer is likely to get damaged on the next high voltage event. So the summary of our inspections are as follows. 27% of the sites had a transformer that creates an open phase safety problem. 60% of the sites, what was built was substantially different than what they told the utility company they would build. No sites complied with utility interconnection settings. 53% of the sites had substantial electrical code violations just in that small little area of the site we looked at, and we also found that the weighted average performance factor was 89% for the 10 sites that we evaluated. So as you might ask yourself, okay, well, that's great. You did some inspection. What's going to come of that? Well, we did those inspections late last year. We processed all the data first part of this year. We shared the findings of this study with Duke Energy at two separate meetings. We also shared the findings with public staff just a month or so ago. And then we also shared this with the solar industry, or the utility industry that's interested in solar, at the Utility Solar Conference in San Diego in April of this year. Now, as a result of this study, Duke Energy is requiring PV plant owners to make changes to the interconnection settings, bring them in line with what they were supposed to have already. They're also implementing additional safety procedures at the sites that have the known problem. And finally, Duke Energy has decided to continue doing these type of inspections for 2015, and not at just Duke Energy Progress location. We're also going to do them at Duke Energy Carolina's sites this year as well. And instead of doing 15 sites, we're going to do 42 sites second half of 2015. That's all I have for my presentation today. Any questions?
So, if you have any questions, you mentioned, Mr. Fitzpatrick, that sometimes the size of the transformer at the solar site is the wrong size. What problems does that cause? Does it cause the step up to the distribution voltage to be the wrong step up, yeah, or what is the
main problem? Would be that if the inverter has a higher output power rating than the transformer, then that may be a problem, and it's not a problem that the utility company was made aware of up front when they did their first evaluation, when they evaluated the interconnection request. So it means no one within the utility company was told about this, and no one has had a chance to look at it. It also means that if they had said they were going to use a delta transformer, but what they actually installed was a Y-type transformer, again, the utility company took them at their word that it was going to be a delta, and looked at a delta type, what effects that would have on the interconnection. And when they change things up like this, it can, turns out, leads to a significant problem, such as this open phase condition that I mentioned.
Okay, well, how do you get the wrong transformer? You go to the transformer store and they're out of what you're looking for and you buy something else?
Well, what happens is developers quickly hire an engineering firm or somebody to put together a one-line electrical drawing to submit with their interconnection request, just to get in the queue. Then when they actually get approved to do the site build, they say, oh, that wasn't actually a good design, let's come up with a new design. And oh, these Y-type transformers are cheaper than delta transformers, let's use a delta or a Y-type transformer. But the problem is that they never communicate that information back to the utility company.
So are there a lot of different installers out there, some with greater sophistication and knowledge than others, and the people who own these arrays are just not getting the best help that they need, or what's the problem here?
Well, that's so these sites were not all built by the same company. I would say they were built by six different companies, and I don't feel comfortable in saying that one company did a great job and other companies didn't. Everyone had failings, definitely.
Okay. Ms. Matthews, you mentioned that the utilities don't want to be the enforcers of the codes, and some of the compliance is 50%, some of it's 70%. Who is the enforcer of the codes, and when there is a non-compliance, what are the penalties?
That's a good question. Well, the enforcer of the energy code is always typically at the local jurisdiction. And so you'll have a number of inspectors that are assigned to that jurisdiction, and they'll say, you didn't pass code, so you're going to have to fix everything, and then I have to come back out to do another inspection. there's a lot of cost, time wasted for the builder to keep going back and forth to get inspection to move to the next process in construction.
Okay, but when they find the non-compliance and you've got to fix it, what happens in between? Is there a financial penalty or just what?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Question for Mr. Fitzpatrick. You mentioned the steps that were taken to address the problems that you found at the specific sites that you inspected. Do you know whether the utility, well, did you make any recommendations to the utility to avoid those types of problems in the future, or do you know whether the utility made any changes to their interconnection agreement or their procedures to avoid those types of problems for the future and at other sites?
Yes, so for the sites we identified the problem, Duke Energy came up with a fix-it list of what needed to be fixed at each site and has communicated this information to the site owner. And for the sites with the known open phase condition problem, they've addressed that with, it's a hotline tag, but anyway, an operating procedure. And then also, they're implementing a new process, I believe starting in July or thereabouts, where sites that didn't originally need to have a recloser, which is a utility company-owned protective device, are now going forward. Any site 1 megawatt and larger will have to have that extra safety device. And one more thing, we're working with Duke Energy to look at the inspection, the upfront inspection process, and see if there are any shortcomings that maybe, not that we know there are. And Duke Energy Carolinas has a very robust process, and their Duke Energy Progress is adopting that same Duke Energy Carolinas process and even modifying it.
Thank you.
Let's, Mr. Fitzpatrick, let's expand on it a little bit. When you say they've got a robust process, does that mean that Duke Energy Carolinas have their own engineers go out and do an inspection of their facility before they do an interconnect, or they have to hire a consultant or Advanced Energy to actually do that prior to they hooking up to the facility?
Duke Energy Carolinas has taken care of this on their own with their own engineering staff. It's just a slight difference in the way the two parts of the company dealt with these sites. And Duke Energy Carolinas was out there at every installation. Duke Energy Progress, was okay with the smaller sites not having this detail, this extra level of detail added. But now, because of this study, they've decided all sites need it.
Well, that was going to be my next question. That makes a lot of sense. It almost looked like you can't depend on the local inspectors to make sure that everything's kosher, because they're going to miss a lot of stuff there. Another question on some of the additional 42 sites you got in the second half of 2000. I was surprised that none of them were 5 megawatts. Are you going to be seeing some 5 megawatts sizes here shortly?
Thanks for that question. Yeah, I didn't say that, but in 2014 we focused on 250 kilowatts up to 2 megawatts was the original focus. In this 2015 work, we're going to be looking at larger sites, lots of 5 megawatts, even up to maybe 20. We haven't put a cap on it, maybe up to 20 or 30 megawatts as well, but definitely a lot of 5 megawatt sites, because that's such a common solar farm size these days.
Thank you, sir.
So, Mr. Fitzpatrick, so following up on that last question, at this point, what would be your expectation going in? Would you expect that the larger systems might have better training and oversight, or would you?
I don't expect it would be different. Same developers and builders building the larger sites, at least up to the 20 megawatt size. No, if we go above 20 megawatts, we probably would see different builders and different quality.
Okay, and then one of the key findings had to do with the protective settings, and you found none were in compliance. Is there some obvious explanations for why?
Yes. So, you know, going back, the oldest site we looked at came online in 2008. And back then, the requirement was just have your inverters complying with the IEEE standard, which I think we all thought they probably were. But it turns out that from the factory, those inverters that were used on those early sites didn't even comply with the IEEE standard from the factory. And back then, no one was asking the inverters to be changed from factory default. It was assumed that the factory default was right. And that's what happened on the older sites. On the newer sites, starting about 2011, the frequency, Duke Energy Progress changed the frequency significantly. Said, all right, no longer is 59 hertz, 59.3 good enough. We need to drop it down to 57. No one changed it. And that's a major difference, and none of the sites changed the settings. They were told to do it, they just didn't do it.
So, kind of big picture, would you think that we're seeing the kind of failures that you were able to find because this is a new industry and the installers may not, in the angst to get going and hire more people, that they may not have done a great job with the training as well as the local inspection officials? This is a new area for them? Or is that not... is that not a reasonable conclusion?
No, that's exactly the conclusion I would come to. The local inspection authority has no idea what this stuff is. They don't know what to look for. The best they can do is looking for a UL label. They don't know what the settings are. They have no clue what the interconnection settings are. The solar developers have always assumed factory default settings must be good. Why would I ever change it? And they've missed that part in the interconnection agreement that says they will change it. So it's just lack of knowledge on, definitely the most lack of knowledge is in the local inspection departments, but the other lack of knowledge is in the engineers with the solar developers.
And one of those pieces appears to be not really realizing you need to go back maybe periodically and be sure everything is in compliance. Or maybe not, but I was
right.
Looking at that transformer one, but then they just didn't even realize they owned the transformer. So.
Right, that's a major problem. If you'll have people with the company engineer who originally designed the system, and then when he leaves that company, no one at that company knows, oh, we own that transformer. It's just when people leave, move from one. Or worse than that is, these sites are frequently sold. They'll be built. A couple years later, they're sold to another capital manager, and all that knowledge of what's actually out there is gone.
So I'll just comment that out of this inspection information was very valuable because it's what's needed to figure out how to make corrections and where the corrections needed to be. So. That's some good work.
It sounds like the saying in the old movie, what we have here is a failure to communicate. what role do you see for Advanced Energy to sort of step into the void here so that you can play a role in eliminate the problems and advancing the cause here a little bit?
Right. So, you know, thus far, we've done this inspection work through our service account work. But you know, what is really needed is every one of these sites needs to be inspected. And there's, you know, our budget's way too small to be able to cover all of that. So that's the kind of thing that Advanced Energy would be interested in doing, but it's going to have to be outside of our service account work as a cash type service. And you know, we feel like we're in a good position to be able to do that work. But we haven't had further discussions about that yet.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you both. Thank you very much. Anything else?
I think that's completes our report.
It's been very informative, as always, and we thank you very much for your presentations.
Thank you.